I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on a closely watched case, Whole Woman's Health v. Helderstedt. At issue was whether a Texas law, HB 2, that mandated that abortion clinics have hospital-like standards and that doctors working there have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, created an undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion. More than half the clinics had closed after that law was passed. Well, the court struck down the Texas law restricting abortion services in a 5-3 decision. Justice Stephen Breyer wrote the majority opinion, saying that the regulations aren't medically necessary and are unconstitutional because they do limit a woman's right to an abortion. This is a major victory for abortion rights activists. We'll be talking about this case, also a ruling on a case involving money, political favors, and the former governor of Virginia. And we'll talk about last week's ruling on affirmative action and its split ruling on immigration. The court, of course, is down one justice. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Ted Ruger, Theodore Ruger. He's the dean and Bernard G. Siegel Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And Ted Ruger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And joining us from NPR is Lisa McElroy. She's Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. She's got a new novel called Called On, and she joins us from the studios of NPR, just ran over from the U.S. Supreme Court. And Lisa, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. It's been an exciting morning.
It sure has. Well, since you're down there in Washington, you were in the court when this decision was announced?
I was.
What was the
Justice Breyer announced the opinion, and he went through his reasoning on a bunch of different points about why these Texas laws were unconstitutional. You could feel a lot of energy in the courtroom as this was happening, both for people who agreed with the majority and were excited about this new development in the law, and probably from some people who disagreed and saw this as a setback.
Ted, how important is this ruling? I'm thinking of Casey v. Planned Parenthood here in Pennsylvania. Where do you put this ruling?
This is very significant because many states were looking to the Texas legislature to enact similar restrictions or burdens on the abortion right that was announced in Casey. And had this decision come out the other way, I think we would have seen an increase in many state legislatures of legislation like this, which added putative health and safety measures, which in reality, as mm-hmm. Justice Breyer's opinion made clear, really didn't go to the safety. They went to making it more difficult to access an abortion. And so this ruling should put a stop to a lot of that legislative activity in other states.
In other states as well. You want to speak to that as well, Lisa? And the argument was whether this law, which had these restrictions, made it more difficult, or I guess too difficult, for a woman to constitutionally or use her constitutional rights for an abortion.
That's right. And in the abortion context, the Supreme Court uses a standard that it doesn't use anywhere else, which is the standard of an undue burden. And Justice Breyer read several points related to the undue burden standard. He said, look, this reduced the number of facilities performing abortions in Texas from 40 to about 7 or 8. And we're talking about, the biggest, other than Alaska, geographical state in the nation. He also pointed out that the waiting times would be much longer. And that was very important in terms of what Texas did and in terms of what other states might follow and do, like Ted said, because if you think about it, you can have a medical abortion where you don't have to have surgery early on in a pregnancy. And as you get later in the pregnancy, you go to surgical abortion being the only option. And then if you get even later, it can be difficult to access abortion at all. And so making it to where abortion was available, or at least facilities could comply with state law in providing abortions statewide, was incredibly important in terms of being able to provide these services at all.
And it seemed in a lot of these cases, Ted, it's Justice Kennedy that people have their eye on. He didn't write the decision, mm-hmm. but it seemed like he was potentially the swing vote, and it looks like he was.
Sure. Indeed, in several of the cases we'll be talking about today that the court issued in the past week, and I'm thinking also of the affirmative action case, Fisher versus Texas. We can talk about how unusual it is that the court is down to 8 justices and it produces these split rulings. However, Justice Kennedy's key status as the median or swing voter still remains in many of these cases.
Does this put and this is a totally silly question, does this put an end to the whole debate about abortion?
To your tale?
No way. And Lisa agrees with me. This is you know, I think what this does, there remains a legitimate and real moral and ethical disagreement about abortion in this country, and there will remain political debate about abortion, and that's okay. What I hope this does is put to rest some of the fallacies from a medical and scientific point of view about the safety of first trimester abortion from the woman's health point of view. I mean, Justice Breyer's opinion cited peer-reviewed studies and basically said this is an extraordinarily safe procedure in the first trimester, and this kind of ramping up of these pseudo-regulations that Texas legislature had tried to do was a blatant effort to distort the science in service of a political end. So I think doctors will like this opinion because it's the Supreme Court majority really taking account of medical science and data about how safe first trimester abortions are.
And yeah, it's not very often that you hear a justice talking about colonoscopies from the bench.
Or liposuction,
said,
hey, right?
Or liposuction, right. And you could see he was just so into it. Ted, you obviously know Justice Breyer very well, and I'm sure you can imagine his face. He was very, you know, intent and looking very carefully out at the gallery and really, you know, saying what an important point this was, how safe this was. And I will say that at least in his announcement of the opinion, he used the phrase right to choose over and over and over again. He really wanted to emphasize that terminology.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm curious about even going back to Texas. So does that undo all those requirements? And do you think, Ted, that would mean that more abortion clinics would either open or reopen? Do we know?
Well, to be specific, what it undoes is the two putative medical safety requirements that Texas had imposed. Number one, that abortion physicians have admitting privileges at a regional hospital. And number two, that abortion clinics meet the same requirements that a surgical outpatient center would be. Now, the court found that neither one of those was medically necessary and indeed was an undue burden. This does not change the fact that many states have things like waiting periods, consent requirements for minors, you know, those things which some people have argued still do burden the abortion choice, those to the extent those have been upheld by prior cases, those are still in place. This goes to these specific Texas medical requirements.
Let's talk a bit about the McDonald case. And this is also a very interesting case that the court overturned the bribery conviction of former Virginia Governor Robert McDonald. They argued that the prosecutors did not prove he took significant official actions in exchange for the $175,000 in gifts and loans. That's a quote from the L.A. Times. Lisa, can I toss this to you? And this was the former governor of Virginia. And a businessman there had given the governor and his family watches and vacations and trips and all sorts of goodies. This was a guy named Johnny R. Williams Sr. And it seemed like he had some business proposals. Can you flesh that out for us, Lisa?
Yeah, the governor's family even got to tool around in Mr. Williams' Ferrari. So you can imagine that's tempting. So Mr. Williams had a nutritional product that was made out of tobacco, and he was really interested in bringing this product to market. In order to bring it to market, though, you have to go through research trials, clinical trials. And he figured out that a really good way to do this would be through the public universities in Virginia. But he needed a way to get the researchers at UVA, for example, to do this research. So he gave a whole bunch of gifts to the McDonald family. As you said, he took the First Lady of Virginia shopping and bought her all these clothes and everything. And then after that, the governor held some meetings. He held a reception at the governor's mansion. He made some phone calls. And the question is whether the governor sort of providing access, sort of helping Mr. Williams get in touch with the right people and using his name to do so, was enough to be an official action such that he would be criminally prosecuted and convicted, as he was.
Well, and I guess I read a quote that McDonald said, yes on the quid, but no on the pro,
right,
or the quo. Mm-hmm. The idea is, yes, this guy gave us stuff, but we didn't do anything out of the ordinary in response. Ted?
Right.
Yeah, this is a fascinating case, and it was unanimous, I should point out. And
oh, that's interesting.
But I think it'll be an interesting teaching case and one that the public can really debate and disagree with, because the proposition is, you know, imagine you own a major pharmaceutical company and you go to the president of the United States and say, hey, I'd really like a private meeting with the head of the FDA, which is considering my drug. the president says, yeah, I'll pick up the phone, and you get that meeting the next day. It's clear the president's intervention in response to your gift produced that meeting. It's clear the meeting is really valuable, right? It's something of value. But the court says because it is the FDA official who makes the official action of deciding yes or no on your drug approval, president didn't do anything official in that context. And that's a textual interpretation that doesn't necessarily comport with the realities of political access.
The idea that people with money use money, they have access, and I guess whether that is some form of, what, legalized bribery? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, yeah, this was a bribery case, and what the government said is that that the governor setting up this very rare and very valuable behind-the-scenes set of meetings and research trials was official action. The court took a much more circumscribed view and said an official act is only one that has legal or regulatory force in and of itself. So it's what the FDA does on a new drug. It's not what the hypothetical president would do in setting up a meeting. And I think, in the realities of political influence, we know that the meetings themselves are very valuable.
Sure, sure. At least you want to add to that.
Yeah, well, and the Chief Justice, in his opinion, really said several times, at least from the bench, both at the beginning and at the end, that there's no question that what happened here was distasteful. We, you know, none of us look at this and say, oh, goody, you know, this guy could, you know, access the governor by giving him a watch and letting him ride in his Ferrari. That does sound pretty bad. But the question isn't, do we dislike it? The question is, can you send somebody to prison for doing this? And the court seemed really influenced by some amicus briefs, some briefs that were filed by friends of the court, people who aren't parties to the action. And these included people who had been in White House counsel's office, state attorney generals, high up in Virginia legal establishment, saying you really can't do this because then any government official is going to have to ask every time they do anything. I was joking last night. I keep getting these emails from the Hillary Clinton campaign about, do you want to go to Hamilton with Hillary?
Oh.
Right. And of course I want to go to Hamilton with Hillary. I do very much. I want to go to Hamilton for sure. But the question is, you know, does she have to check that out every time she has a meeting? If she gets me into Hamilton, if she gets Ted into Hamilton, where is the line? And I think they're saying it's really important to make sure that when we're criminally prosecuting somebody, that we really know what that line is and that it's a very serious line.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about some very important decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court this morning. That's Lisa McElroy, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. And she's got a new novel. It's called Called On. Also with us is Ted Ruger. He's the Dean and the Bernard G. Siegel Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. He clerked for Justice Breyer, and we are talking about the decisions that have come down this morning. Also, last week's important decisions on affirmative action and immigration. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Lisa McElroy and Ted Ruger about Supreme Court decisions from this morning, essentially striking down a Texas law 5-3, a law that had been set up instituting some pretty strict regulations on abortion clinics, also saying that doctors who worked at these abortion clinics had to have visiting privileges at nearby hospitals. And the court struck down those regulations. Also talking about a court case involving a former Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell. And talking about the fact that the Supreme Court said that when he was convicted of, I guess, what, some form of bribery, that really was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. It was a unanimous decision. And again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. During the break, Ted and I were talking a little bit about just the fact that so much of politics and politicking has to do with money and whether that also is sort of embedded in a decision like this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this, you know, we can see this in the broader context of decisions like Citizens United involving money and politics, and I think some will critique this decision as just another way in which monetary influence can come to bear. Now, I should clarify, These are not campaign contributions. These are personal gifts.
Right.
And so I should say, in the federal government and in many other states, not Virginia, these would have been disallowed and illegal, and not on a quid pro quo basis, but even the quid, even the gift itself,
the gift
of a monetary value more than, say, $50 or $100 would be unauthorized if given to a member of Congress or a member of the federal executive branch. So when we look at how much mischief this decision will produce, we ought to be comforted at least that there's very strict gift rules on members of the federal executive branch and Congress.
So some limitations on where this might go. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Lisa, the court also released an opinion today having to do with a gun ban and domestic violence, upholding a law that can ban people convicted of domestic violence from owning guns. Again, can you were in the courtroom today, flesh that out for us.
Yeah, so this one didn't get quite as much attention either from the public or from the justices, whereas they spent, I'd say, a good half hour reading their opinions in the abortion case. On this case about guns, it was maybe 3 minutes. And Justice Kagan had this, and basically she talked about the different states of mind in criminal law, whether you do something intentionally or knowingly or recklessly. And they basically decided that the reckless standard would apply here. If you know that there's some substantial likelihood that harm is going to occur, that would count for purposes of this firearms provision.
The idea that if someone is convicted of domestic violence, Ted, that they shouldn't be able to buy a gun. Is that basically what the court is saying?
That's right. That's the federal law makes it illegal to buy or own a gun if you have a domestic violence conviction.
And that is that considered controversial as a decision, or does it kind of underscore we're talking about guns,
right?
Obviously.
It's controversial because it involves guns, and therefore it implicates the perceptions of the Second Amendment. And indeed, the folks challenging the law had said, well, it's okay if you have an intentional domestic violence conviction. But what had happened here was defendants from Maine had, in the heat of argument, struck their partners. And the claim was, which was rejected by the court, that, something that was only, and I'm using that in quotes,
sure,
reckless as opposed to intentional shouldn't be enough to deprive the Second Amendment inflected rights. And the court rejected that. And I think what the idea here is that, and the way it fits with the political debate, is it stands for the proposition that restrictions on the right to own guns or carry guns can be driven by a number of behavioral consequences. It may inflect the debate about the terrorist watch list or the no-fly list if the politicians want to take action on that. Another way to put it is the Second Amendment is not absolute. It can be modified.
And isn't that what Scalia said in the Heller decision? I mean, the Heller decision would sort of uphold, said that an individual has a right to gun, but that there was room for restrictions.
Sure. No judge, even those who, like the late Justice Scalia, who favored a more expansive individual right to carry and own guns, no judge has ever said that the Second Amendment is so absolute as to prevent reasonable regulations or restrictions on that.
Lisa, you want to add to that?
Yeah, really none of our rights are absolute.
Right.
Pretty much any right that we have under the Constitution can be restricted on various grounds, and there are different ways that the court chooses to look at those things. But what Justice Kagan was saying for the court here today was, look, we don't want to encourage people to do things. I think the example she gave was throw a plate at the wall in anger, and you know that if the plate breaks, the shard might hit your partner. That's just as bad as throwing the plate directly at somebody. So, thinking about where guns fit into the greater picture of violence in general.
Lisa, and to you, Ted, as well, and listeners as well, we have a eight-member court. How do you think, even Lisa, looking back at the decisions over the last couple of weeks, how does that eight-member court play out in some of these decisions?
Well, you know, so much of what happens at the court is behind the scenes. In fact, pretty much everything is behind the scenes. And it's a very secretive place. And so we can only speculate so much of the time. And a lot of that speculation has to do with how would Justice Scalia have voted. But also sometimes it has to do with, was Justice Scalia influential? Could he have, you know, walked down the hall and talked to one of his colleagues and said, hey, I really think you have this wrong. I want you to, you know, think about it from my point of view. You know, this particularly came up, I think, people saying in the affirmative action decision. If Justice Scalia had been there, it might have been 4-4 in terms of Justice Scalia voting. And then the Texas, it still would have come out the same way because the Fifth Circuit, the Supreme Court affirmed the Fifth Circuit. But would Justice Scalia have had more influence, for example?
And curious, too, about just where things stand with Judge Garland. It looks like, Ted, the Senate is not going to move forward. Are they on thin or thick or thin or thin ice in deciding that they're just not going to vote on whether Garland should be on the Supreme Court or not?
Well, I think the political prediction is clear that they haven't held hearings or put him up for vote, and I don't expect they will. At least, it may be quite interesting what happens if Hillary Clinton wins the election, whether they would rush to try to have hearings on Garland.
Thinking she might go with someone even
indeed,
more liberal?
Indeed. And the arguments, you know, that both sides have arguments about whether or not he ought to get a hearing. I mean, certainly this is unusually long period for the Senate not to grant a hearing. And there's kind of early framing era evidence, actually one of the Federalist papers written by Alexander Hamilton, you know, suggests that the Senate ought to step up to the plate. He didn't use those terms.
No.
But, you know, that essentially the Senate has to make its decision on the president's nominee, and therefore the Senate holds itself accountable. So what bothers me, and I think would have bothered the framers about holding Judge Garland in limbo, is the Senate is not really is avoiding responsibility for voting thumbs up or thumbs down. By no means does the Senate have to confirm the president's nominee, but it avoids the political accountability by avoiding the vote.
And Lisa, I mean, this assuming that they don't vote or don't have hearings at all, this could go on for more than a year, I guess, because whoever becomes the next president, then they have to nominate someone and there's a process involved. How much do you think that hurts the court?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a really, really good question, because not only are we thinking about individual justices and how justices vote, but we know there's been a lot of empirical evidence that it's also an institutional type thing. So the way a particular group of nine work together fundamentally changes when you take one person out or put a new person in. And so this body of eight is undoubtedly a little bit different than it was, and not just because Justice Scalia is absent, but because their institution, their partnership has changed. I will say that I think another thing that's very, very interesting is if Hillary Clinton were to win the presidency, the next thing we have to look at is who wins the Senate in November. Because if the Democrats take the Senate, then it really is a good question. Do they want to try to rush Garland through? Or if that doesn't happen and Hillary becomes president after her inauguration, would she stick with Garland? Or would she just say, thank you very much, Judge Garland. You did a real service to our country by being a placeholder for us here. But actually, I'm going to go for somebody else because I think I can get that person through. And the optics will really matter to her.
Well, and this, of course, is the politics that we are involved in, Ted, whether, you know, Congress or maybe, I mean, obviously the Supreme Court can do its job. I mean, they can vote, they can hear cases. It's just that there are eight of them instead of nine of them.
Well, and I think that the extent to which this actually, if we view the Supreme Court's job as to use Chief Justice John Marshall's phrase, you know, to say what the law is, we saw one case last week where this eight-justice court really fell down on the job through no fault of its own, but with a split court, and this is the immigration case, where the court voted 4-4 and with a one-sentence opinion let the lower court opinion stand, which therefore the lower court opinion had blocked President Obama's deferred action plan. Therefore, the law of the land now is that the deferred action plan for parents is blocked. This is a huge immigration ruling, and we don't know what the court's rationale was. So, you know, one thing that has become an accepted part of an important part of Supreme Court decision making is when the justices do something important, they give us their reasons.
Right? And their names, too.
And their names. So that's a form of accountability as well. And we in the political and legal community can debate those reasons. They also help guide us in future cases. We got none of that in the immigration ruling. And that is a real a deficit in an 8-justice court compared to a 9-justice court.
And just to summarize, President Obama had used his executive authority to prevent the deportation of parents of U.S. citizens, mm-hmm. allowing them to get work permits so that they could go to work. His complaint was that Congress wasn't doing anything, mm-hmm. so he was going to step in. Lisa, where does then that leave those parents?
Well, this is a really weird situation because, you know, what happened was that the president was basically saying, hey, you know, officially don't deport these people. And the question was whether he had the authority to do that. But one really interesting aspect that Ted alluded to was that this district court judge, this trial court judge in Texas, issued a nationwide injunction. In other words, it didn't just apply to Texas or the Fifth Circuit, which is the area of country around Texas. As of right now, it looks as if this is a nationwide injunction. It's not going to go into effect anywhere in the country. And there's a real question as to whether that you can do that. So we've got all of these questions about authority and how it works.
Anything you want to add to that, Ted?
Well, I just would agree with Lisa. This is striking. But the other problem with not having reasons on the record is if you could imagine a 5-4 ruling upholding the lower court decision and
Absolutely.
Thus striking down President Obama's plan. However, that ruling with 5 justices would have had lots of generalizable restrictions on executive overreach that would have been relevant in a Clinton administration, in a Trump administration. We don't have that now. So this is a ruling that essentially blocks the president's immigration plan but doesn't lay down important precedents to restrain executive authority in other contexts, which might have been quite important and quite useful.
Well, we are talking about Supreme Court rulings of the last couple of weeks, including a couple that came down this morning. That's Ted Ruger and Lisa McElroy with us as well. And you can join us by calling 1-888-477-9499. This is very important stuff. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Are you drinking more than you want to?
That was
to?
My mistake. We'll pull the promo down. I got a little confused there. Well, let me put something else on the table here, and this is upholding the University of Texas affirmative action case. This was a case involving a young woman named Abigail Fisher. She had been denied admission to the Austin campus of the University of Texas, and she said because she was white, it was because of her race. The court did not agree with her. Ted, what did the court do? What did they say?
Well, the court laid down a few important principles, and in this case it was actually a 5-2 decision, Justice Kennedy, or I should say it's a 4-3 decision.
4-3.
Justice Kagan was recused, and then we didn't have Justice Scalia. So it was a 4-3 decision upholding what the state of the law has been really for several decades, which is that universities and colleges have the discretion to take all factors of an individual's background into account in the admissions decision as long as we don't make that a rigid formula or a quota. We can look at the whole file. And the court upheld that principle and said that, number one, building a diverse and eclectic group of students in the student body is a valid educational interest, something we certainly believe at Penn. Number two, and this is also very important to educational institutions around the country, that one component of academic freedom is that educational institutions have the discretion and the decision-making authority to form our own classes of students and that it not be dictated or micromanaged by 5 justices in Washington, D.C. And in a sense, that was what the plaintiff, Abigail Fisher, was asking for, that a slim majority of the Supreme Court kind of remove a key aspect of our discretion in deciding what kind of student body will best achieve our aims at a place like Penn Law School. So these are very important principles, and you know we certainly were pleased to see the Supreme Court, led by Justice Kennedy in this case, keeping the law as it is so that we can continue this long process of educating students and building the kind of student body that that fits with 21st century America.
Lisa, Justice Alito did not agree with that. He called this affirmative action gone berserk. What was he referring to?
Well, he had enormous concerns, as do many of the justices in the conservative wing, about using race at all. The chief really feels that if you use race, you use race, and it doesn't matter which way you're doing it. Justice Alito also pointed out that when the first Fisher case happened a few years ago, and we should say that Abigail Fisher has been litigating this case for something like 8 or 9 years now. I mean, she's graduated from college, decades ago herself at this point. And, that the court seemed to be stricter on this in Fisher 1 than they now were in Fisher 2. So what is the standard? Can we just change it on a dime? What are we doing here? And remarkably, I think many of us did not think that Justice Kennedy would go this way. Justice Kennedy typically has not been in favor of affirmative action programs based on race. And so this came as a real surprise in this case. And I think maybe that befuddled Justice Alito a little bit.
Affirmative action gone berserk, Ted.
Well, I think, yeah, and I think what was the other, there was a unique thing not applicable outside of the University of Texas, where the Texas, in a sense, had a different kind of plan to achieve diversity called the 10% plan, right, where anybody in the top 10% of a Texas public high school could be admitted. And then they, on addition to that, they added in individualized consideration of race. So that's another way that I think the opponents of the Texas plan thought that it was too much affirmative action, as it were. And that's very limited to Texas.
And that's limited to Texas. And that's Ted Ruger. He's Dean, the Bernard G. Siegel Professor of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Also with us, Lisa McElroy, Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's Thomas R. Klein School of Law. And we've been talking about what the Supreme Court did this morning and just about an hour ago, and also talking about some of the important decisions they have been making over the last week or so. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Just a recap here. The U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Texas law restricting abortion services in a 5-3 decision, a very important decision. The court also overturned the bribery conviction of former Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell. It also upheld a law that bans people convicted of domestic violence from owning guns. They upheld an affirmative action case involving the University of Texas, basically upholding affirmative action, and also had a kind of a draw on President Obama's use of executive authority having to do with immigration. Just five of a number of really important cases decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, talking with Ted Ruger and Lisa McElroy, and we want to hear from you. This is your Supreme Court. These are decisions that will affect all of us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Lisa, we weren't sure. I'm not sure whether you can speak to a case having to do with illegal stops. This is something that the court ruled on, essentially, that evidence gotten after an illegal stop is considered legal. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so this was actually a really interesting case, and one that I think involved a lot of passion versus sort of reason, and different ways that we look at analyzing the law and that the Supreme Court does. What happened was that in Utah, there was a house where it was suspected that drug dealing was going on. The police had gotten an anonymous tip. And so the police were watching this house, and they saw people coming in and out. Well, a police officer stopped a gentleman who came out and said, what were you doing in there? And that was definitely an illegal stop for a variety of reasons. Nobody disagreed that the stop itself was unconstitutional. But it was what happened next where the controversy came up. The officer asked for the guy's ID. He ran the ID. Mm-hmm. And when he ran the ID, he found out that there was a warrant for this guy's arrest. And it wasn't for burglary or armed robbery or something. It was for a very minor traffic violation. And it turns out, as some members of the court said in a dissent that so many of us have these warrants for arrest for parking tickets. I mean, you know, we all live in Philadelphia, Marty
yes,
and Ted. You know how easy it is to get a parking
yes.
ticket, right?
Yes.
And it turns out in New Jersey, if you have two parking tickets, automatic warrant for your arrest. And so what the concern was here was that are we giving this huge tool to the police? And Justice Thomas, in his majority opinion, said, look, it really doesn't matter. Yes, the stop was illegal, but what happened afterwards was attenuated enough. It wasn't connected enough, and there was this valid arrest warrant so that when the police officer searched the guy and found drug paraphernalia, that was perfectly okay. It was now a search incident to arrest. And Justice Sotomayor absolutely freaked out, if you'll let me use that language. She
in,
said,
in judicial terms or
in judicial
ways?
In judicial terms, yes, she did. She said, look, I don't understand how you can possibly be thinking this way in the real world. She said, we know who gets stopped in the real world. The people who get stopped are people of color. Parents of color have to warn their children about how to act around the police. And she said, this is disproportionately going to affect people where the police previously couldn't have done this, couldn't have searched them. Now they can, and we're suddenly going to be seeing the police really wielding this tool in a way that is going to be disproportionately affect people.
And Ted, in many ways, this is about the Fourth Amendment, right? About unreasonable search and seizure?
Well, but as Lisa pointed out, and in channeling Justice Sotomayor, it's technically about the Fourth Amendment doctrine, but it also is about our principle of equality and even-handed mm-hmm. administration of justice. Because if you give the police leeway to look back into somebody's record and see if they're in the system, well, we are not evenly distributed by race and social class in terms of whether we've had interactions in the criminal justice system. So this could well redound unequally, you know, in the actual administration of justice. And that's clearly Justice Sotomayor's concern.
Well, and if I could say one more thing, Marty.
Yeah, please.
Certainly, again, I want to say, you know, it's so secretive what happens behind the scenes. And I wanted to actually say something again about the affirmative action case about
sure.
that. But I do find the optics of it very, very interesting that Justice Thomas wrote the majority opinion here. Because what Justice Sotomayor, and it was very clear during oral argument that Justice Sotomayor felt very strongly about the racial implications of this. She made that clear. So clearly when she went back and talked to the justices, this came up in their discussion. You wonder if it was intentional for Justice Thomas to have this assignment as the other person of color on the court to say, no, that isn't a relevant consideration here for the court.
And is that Roberts, he's the one, the Chief Justice decides who writes these opinions?
That's right. And the chief can assign it based on workload. The chief can assign it because sometimes a particular justice has a particular interest in a doctrinal area. Or maybe Justice Thomas held up his hand and said, hey, chief, give it to me. I'll take it.
Yeah. You wanted to talk about the Fisher cases too, as well, Lisa?
Yeah, well, it's just another thing, you know, and one of the things that fascinates me about the Supreme Court and that I've written a lot about, and I know this is an interest of Ted's as well, is that the court really hides most of what it does behind these velvet curtains that it has in the courtroom. And I argue a lot for more transparency at the court. But with Fisher, the affirmative action decision, one thing that really struck me was this. We did not expect Kennedy to vote the way he voted, because as I said before, he's never done this in an affirmative action case. And here we didn't have a chance of a 4-4 split. We had 4-3 because mm-hmm. Justice Kagan couldn't participate. Kennedy's opinion was about 20 pages. Justice Alito, and you said, you know, the whole thing, affirmative action gone berserk, right, was 51 pages. And you almost wonder, did Justice Alito originally have the majority? Did he originally write the majority, and then somehow he lost Justice Kennedy? And that would certainly be a reason why, you know, we said Sotomayor freak out. Here's Alito freak out, mm-hmm. right? Affirmative action gone berserk. What do you think, Ted?
Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, that's plausible. I hadn't thought about it. I completely agree with you that, you know, the Supreme Court is a remarkably non-transparent decision in its internal decision-making before the decisions come down. And indeed, they've even gone so far as to embargo the release of internal judicial papers for decades. So we may not know for decades what really happened here. But it is quite possible, particularly if the original vote was while Justice Scalia was on the court, if Kennedy formed five votes. I think it – remember, with Kagan recused, there's been a long-standing norm going back two centuries that the Supreme Court doesn't make major constitutional law with less than a full majority. So, you know, I think it's implausible that once Justice Scalia passed away, that Justice Kennedy would have provided the swing vote for a 4-3 decision striking down affirmative action in ways that would have been cataclysmic for universities. However, if there had been five votes for that, I think Lisa's right. That could have been the original majority opinion. And we won't know for a few years.
And we won't know.
We won't know while we're alive.
And will we ever have cameras in the courtroom, Lisa?
Oh, my gosh. So this is my soapbox. We so should have cameras in the courtroom. I mean, something like this morning where these major decisions happened. And, you know, just being able to look up at the bench and see these three women sitting up there, where when I was in high school, we got our first woman, you know. People should be able to see their government at work. People should be able to see what this amazing court is doing. And I really think that it would foster people's confidence in the court and add to the legitimacy of the court. But the justices do not want this. They are absolutely – Justice Souter said over his dead body would they roll cameras into that courtroom. And we see no progress on this point whatsoever.
Maybe once we get millennials who grow up and sit on the Supreme Court, Ted, that we'll have cameras and tweeting and all sorts of things in the courtroom.
It could be a long time. This is one area – you know, we talk about a split court. This is one where – there's a bipartisan consensus among the justices that they value their anonymity and they don't want cameras in the courtroom. But I share Lisa's sense that it would be a tremendous civic education. I mean, having sat in on a number of Supreme Court arguments, it the quality of oral argument and questioning today is you know arguably the highest it's been in history. I've listened to tapes from the Warren
today,
Court. The bench today is more active and more prepared than they were in the 1960s. The Supreme Court bar is better and more prepared than it's ever been, and it's you know, let me put it this way: it's so far more substantive than much of what we see on C-SPAN with the other branches that it would be a good thing for the court, but the justices don't want it.
Lisa, let me.
They're not going to let them have a sit-in at the Supreme Court either. That's just not. They won't even let the protesters up off the below the step. Can I say one more thing about millennials, Marty? Because this was very funny being at the court this morning. I got to the court about maybe 8:45 this morning, and of course the opinions start at 10. And as I came in, you know, you would expect. I mean, we knew we were getting this abortion decision today. You would expect to see people out there just hating on each other, and instead, what was happening was it was all millennials out there. They were playing Let's Talk About Sex. They were playing Dirty Dancing. Everybody was dancing. Even the police officers, and Ted, you've spent a lot of time at the court, even the police officers standing there were dancing and sort of bebopping to this music. It was hysterical. Not what you would have thought.
Do you think that they were anticipating a decision that would favor their side, Lisa?
I think most of us at this point did, because it seemed like probably the court was not split 4-4, because on last Thursday they announced these 2-4-4 opinions. So we thought, well, probably they would have said last week if it were 4-4. So we thought there had to be a majority, right? And you would have the four liberals, that would be Kagan, Sotomayor, Breyer, and Ginsburg. And then to have a fifth, you had to have Kennedy, right? So it seemed like it was probably going to go okay, but you never know. And I will say one thing nobody called, I don't know if you did, Ted, was that Justice Breyer would have this opinion.
Oh, interesting. And you're shaking your head no. Let me get Christine from West Philadelphia to join us. Christine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, hello. Thank you so much for this show.
Sure.
I'm curious if during his lengthy reading of his decision, did Breyer mention other medical information such as apparently these clinics are telling the patient that she's risking having breast cancer by having an abortion performed, which medical science has said that's not true at all. Did he speak more about other medical aspects of abortion versus giving birth to a child?
Yeah, Lisa, you were in the courtroom. Did that come up?
He didn't say anything like that specifically. You need to remember that when the justices are up there, they are conscious of time, and so they don't get into every detail. But he did emphasize over and over again the safety of abortion and that, you know, claims that this was a dangerous procedure for women were not only inflated but just plain wrong. One medical point he did bring up was that when they had, during the oral argument, they had asked the Solicitor General of Texas if they had ever had a situation ever where they had had to employ these emergency procedures where the admitting privileges would be needed. And the Solicitor General of Texas said they could not point to a single one.
Huh, interesting. That's Lisa McElroy from Drexel University School of Law. Also with us, Ted Ruger, and he's Dean of the Law School at the University of Pennsylvania. We are talking about today's Supreme Court rulings, also some decisions from last week as well. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Some email comments here, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. An email from Will. What happens to Mrs. McDonald's obstruction of justice conviction? I'm looking at you, Ted. Do we know? And this was all, I guess they were together. I believe they have separated since. But what happens to her? Do we know?
No, it's a great question, and I didn't look today to see what has developed there. But my what I would say is that it's independent prosecutions, and more importantly, independent statutory text. So obstruction of justice would hinge on different predicate acts than the official act, which was important for the bribery. So I think that without looking back at the opinion, my strong sense is this won't affect or help her case the way it helped her husband or ex-husband.
Lisa, you want to weigh in on that at all?
You know, I am not at all a criminal law expert. My only question is, can you obstruct justice if there was no crime committed, which is basically what the court said today. So I don't know the answer to that question. I do think an interesting question, though, for us in Philadelphia, and I don't know enough about the Pennsylvania law on point, is how this applies in the Fatah case, which I know you've been covering a lot, Marty.
We have, yeah. And that's, I think, a bit of a question mark, but convicted on more than 20 counts of a whole host of criminal allegations there. We're almost out of time here, but I'm curious, and Lisa, you mentioned the fact that Sotomayor was so active on some of these cases. Has she taken the place, if I can put it that way, of Antonin Scalia in terms of her outspokenness or maybe even just the way she kind of wields the judicial power that she has?
Justice Sotomayor has always been active from her first day on the court. And there even were some questions that frankly, I wonder would have been asked if she were a man about was she kind of wielding her power or whatever a little bit too much? Was she talking too much? Was she asking too many questions? She is very, very engaged in this court. And of course, because she was a trial court judge and because she was, you know, involved in the criminal justice system, she knows a lot about these criminal cases. And of course, she brings a perspective as a person of color on the court as well.
Ted, final word from you.
And I would just add, she's more so than any justice I can think of, she's providing a distinctive voice because she's very explicit about the way in which her experiences inflect her thinking about the law. And we know that is true for other justices. Right. They're just not always as candid. So her voice,
as a Latina, for instance.
Correct. Well, and just speaking about race and gender and the way that she views that inflected in the law.
Yeah. Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Ted Ruger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's Dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Lisa McElroy, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
Big day.
Yeah, big day. Absolutely. And I appreciate the fact that you both could scurry over and join us on Radio Times. And she's Associate Professor of Law at Drexel University's School of Law. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. Madison Poulter, our intern. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. I gave him a fright today. And the show is produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.